Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Lauren Litton. I am the host of Spotlight on Youth, the radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, you're simply going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad and you'll be placed in a queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose your questions there. On this episode, we're talking about the prevention of youth violence. Violence is a serious public health problem that has substantial impact on individuals, families, and communities. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, every day in the United States, approximately 13 kids are victims of homicide, and an additional 1,600 are treated for physical assault-related injuries. This makes homicide the third leading cause of death among young people aged 10 to 24, which is responsible for more deaths in this age group than the next 7 leading causes of death combined, which includes cancer, diabetes, and other health-related problems. Youth violence covers a wide spectrum of acts, including bullying, fighting, gang-related activity, and dating violence. It is costly, affects quality of life, and disproportionately impacts marginalized communities. We are losing future leaders, future employers, and workers. Youth violence is caused by numerous factors, and its prevention requires multiple strategies and partners, focusing on both risk and resilience. Across the country, cities are looking to implement comprehensive approaches, and today's guests are going to share their experiences with youth violence prevention strategies and discuss critical lessons learned for other communities considering a public health approach to this issue. Our guests are Sasha Cotton, who is the Youth Violence Prevention Coordinator for the City of Minneapolis, where she serves as a liaison between the city and the community and helps to improve communication among city officials, community organizations, and all citizens concerned with youth violence. Sasha has an extensive background in providing technical assistance, training, and implementation of community engagement strategies related to violence prevention in diverse communities. Previously, she worked in community corrections as a National Resource Center Coordinator at the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community and as the Prevention Program Manager for the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. Chris Gunther is the Manager of Strategic Initiatives at the New Orleans Health Department. In this role, he oversees the department's programs related to violence prevention, family health, and health care access. As a part of NOLA for Life, Chris has led initiatives to prevent family violence, build trauma readiness and resiliency in schools, and coordinate behavioral health services. As site coordinator for the National Forum on Youth Violence Prevention, he has coordinated the development and implementation of the NOLA for Life playbook, a strategic plan to prevent youth violence in New Orleans. Previously, he taught middle school science and elementary school literacy. Rachel Davis is the Managing Director at the Prevention Institute. She serves on the senior management team and oversees the Institute's work on violence and trauma prevention, health equity, and mental health. Rachel serves as a Project Director for UNITY, which stands for Urban Networks to Increase Thriving Youth through Violence Prevention, a national initiative to strengthen and support the largest U.S. cities in more effectively preventing violence. She also co-authored and co-developed Thrive, a toolkit that assists communities to identify and foster factors in their community environment that can improve health outcomes, reduce inequity, and promote resilience. Previously, Rachel worked as a social worker for the San Francisco Unified School District. So welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having us.
Well, excited to have you all on the show. I did a brief introduction, Rachel, about youth violence, but what makes this really a public health issue?
Well, I think that's a very important question, and obviously a number of the statistics that you cited in your opening comments really affirm why this is such an important public health issue. What I would add to that is I think there's really four overarching reasons that I would describe this as a public health issue. The first, as the statistics you cited really inferred, that this is really a leading cause of death, injury, and disability for young people in this country. Secondly, it's a significant disparity in health outcomes. And while homicide, for example, is the second leading cause of death for all young people, it's the first leading cause of death for African Americans aged 10 to 24. Third, violence really increases the risk of other poor health outcomes. So we know, for example, that people who have experienced or witnessed violence are at higher risk for asthma. We know that violence and fear of violence in communities is really a barrier to healthy eating and active living, which can really then be a risk factor for chronic illnesses later on. And the fourth reason this is a public health issue is because it's preventable. And that's very important because, and I think we'll be hearing examples throughout today's show about violence as a preventable public health issue.
Chris or Sasha, is there anything you want to add to that?
Go ahead, Chris.
All right, sorry. I'll add a few reasons of why, for us in New Orleans specifically, it's a public health issue on top of the ones that Rachel mentioned, which are important for us here as well. The two reasons for us are, first, that our mayor believes that it's a public health issue strongly. He uses that language and describes it as an epidemic, as a public health crisis, and has specifically asked our health department to be involved in leading efforts around prevention of youth violence. And so when our mayor asks us to do something, that's a strong ask. And so that's something that we really have to take on. And we're happy to play that leadership role. The second reason is just as important for us, though, it's because our community partners have told us repeatedly that it is a public health issue. 4 years ago, our department was undergoing a transformation and reconsidering our priorities for improving population health in the city, and had a lot of conversations with community partners about what our priorities should be going forward. And the number one priority that our partners voiced was that violence was a public health issue in New Orleans, and that if we wanted to improve the health of the city, we had to do something about violence.
And I would just add that in Minneapolis, we also approach our youth violence prevention work from the health department using a public health approach, and that it has really been a great tool in getting community partners to the table, that at times doing violence prevention work using a criminal justice format or a law enforcement format can be challenging to getting certain partners at the table. And so using the public health framework has really been helpful in securing that all people feel like it's a resource they can tap into, knowing that health is important to the viability of any community and people feel like it's something that they can engage around. So I think that that's been a great way to make it user-friendly.
And I really want to hear what brought each of you personally to this work, but I didn't know if anyone wants to maybe even explain a little bit better than I did, surely in an introduction, of what we even mean by youth violence. Does anyone
want to
try that?
Well, I know when we think about youth violence in New Orleans, we're thinking about violence that is either perpetrated by or is or victims are the ages. For us, specifically focus on 16 to 24, but increasingly are thinking about younger ages down to the age of 10 and even younger, including some of the statistics that Lauren, you and Rachel have mentioned, is typically the age range that we're thinking about.
And that is a similar framework to what we use in Minneapolis. We really look at 10 to 24 as our target demographic, but under the leadership of our new mayor, Mayor Hodges, who has a particular interest in the outcomes for early childhood issues, we're looking younger and younger at both perpetration and victimization of violence. And so really thinking about how early childhood exposure to violence impacts and influences what happens to young people when they come of age into that 10 to 24-year age bracket. So we're pulling together partners to talk about domestic violence, sexual violence, and other childhood exposure related areas to really think critically about how we can get out in front of the problem of youth violence before it even starts.
Yeah, and I think that that's really a trend that we're seeing that's reflected in comments that Chris and Sasha just made, is that really, while, for example, CDC defines youth violence as 10 to 24, what we know is that multiple forms of violence are interrelated, and what young people are experiencing at an earlier age is a risk factor later on. And we also know that a lot of the violence that's really impacting inner cities extends up to about 35-year-olds. So a lot of cities are really taking approaches that span much more developmentally beyond just the 10 to 24-year-old range in a much more holistic way.
Hmm. And
yeah,
we
I think
are
that's
going
really...
to... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Sasha.
Oh, excuse me. No, I was just going to say that I think that that's so important. With my background, having worked in domestic violence for many years, we know that outcomes are dramatically different when interventions aren't taken for young people who grow up in homes where violence is prevalent between parents or parents and their partners. And so I think seeing that trend is really a move in the right direction from many cities who are taking on the issue of looking younger and younger and how we can begin to really take a prevention lens with younger children.
And what I was going to say is I think we are going to spend time in this next hour delving into how each of your cities approach this and also some trends that are happening. As I mentioned, I wanted to hear from each of you what brought you personally to this work. And Sasha, you just mentioned that you had worked in the domestic violence field as well. So why don't you start us off?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And thanks again for having me on air today, Lauren. For me personally, coming from an urban area in the Twin Cities and being a woman of color from diverse communities of color in my background, and seeing the disproportionate rate at which violence impacts my community, it's a personal commitment that I have, and knowing that there's sort of this overarching issue of violence in many communities, and that if we can't get out in front of that problem, a lot of the other social ills like poverty and education and employment gaps will be very challenging to fill. And so for me, violence is a motivator, or violence prevention, I should say, is a motivator to really looking at community empowerment and knowing that communities find themselves entrenched in violence, but also really are hopeful about what they can do to get out in front of the problem, to prevent it, and to intervene and make sure that it doesn't become an ongoing pattern of behavior. And so I have a personal commitment. I also have two teenage sons, so who are men of color, and so it's personal on that level as well that we know disproportionately boys of color are, at risk for violence. And so it's a personal matter for me, but professionally, we've really seen the industry grow beyond just looking at how do we lock up young people who make mistakes and really trends towards how do we restore them and how do we make them vital parts of our community once they've learned from their mistakes. And so it's just a really exciting time to be in the work.
Mm-hmm. Who wants to go next?
Sure, I can jump in. Lauren, in your introduction, you mentioned that I have a background as a teacher, and that was sort of my entree to this field. I, as a teacher of middle school science, my first year in New Orleans, I had a number of students have encounters with violence and saw the impact that violence had on my students, and many days, and saw the other challenges that my students faced as well, just beyond the issue of exposure to violence. And so many days trying to teach kids about the parts of a cell, for example, felt like the least important thing that I could be doing. At the same time, there was increasing awareness around the city of New Orleans about the extremely high rates of violence here, and an increasing public conversation about solutions for that. And as a part of those conversations, I was exposed to public health as a possible solution for violence, and violence is a public health issue. I had a background in public health previously, an academic background, and was interested in public health as a career, but had always thought that my career path would eventually take me internationally. But based on my experience as a classroom teacher, that really changed my trajectory, and I made a commitment to stay here and work on the issue of violence, which is something that I feel really passionately about. So now, you know, I'm not obviously in the classroom. Very infrequently do I get to see the direct impact of the work that I do, but maintain really good connections with the education community here. My partner and many close friends are still teachers and in the field of education. So the work that I do is really on behalf of my students.
And similar to Chris, I came into this work through my professional work. You mentioned that previously I was a school social worker, and in that position, I was really dealing with children and families where there were high rates of violence in families and in the community. And at one point in that work, and this is nearly two decades ago now, our fourth grade boys started getting recruited into gangs, and we felt really helpless, and we didn't know what to do. And, you know, we were losing these young, you know, children to a very violent lifestyle, and we were really concerned about that. And at that time, I actually found a class that was a public health class about dealing with community violence, and I decided to take the class looking for the magic answer to sort of solve this problem of, you know, what was happening to the young boys in our school. And, you know, what I really came to understand was an approach that there's no magic answer, but that there's answers, and that together we can put a mosaic and a fabric in place that can really be protective against that happening.
Great. You, all of you actually started talking about some changes already now. You know, the trend is to be more inclusive of younger individuals. How has the approach to youth violence changed over the years, and what's been the outcomes?
Well, this is Rachel, and maybe I'll start and just talk about what we've seen from a national landscape perspective. When we started Unity, we did a national assessment, and we did interviews with mayors and public health directors, school superintendents, and police chiefs in a third of the largest cities in the United States. And what we found at that time, and this was about 2005, 2006, was that criminal justice and law enforcement approaches were the primary approach that cities were taking. Cities didn't have strategic plans in place. They didn't have evaluation in place. They largely weren't focused on prevention and didn't really know if other folks in their city were focused on prevention. And we also learned that public health was not seen as part of the solution, nor did it see itself as part of the solution. And, you know, fast forwarding to now, there's really been a tremendous change. And what we're seeing, and I think certainly, you know, Minneapolis and New Orleans are just really excellent examples of this, is we're really seeing a shift to comprehensive approaches and strategic plans that the approaches are much more balanced now beyond just suppression and enforcement, and include intervention and prevention as part of what cities are really prioritizing. There's really a shift to multi-sector engagement. So it used to be primarily law enforcement and criminal justice sectors, and now we're seeing libraries and parks and rec and and the schools as part of a coordinated approach, and public works getting involved. And so really the engagement of multiple sectors in a coordinated way. The other thing we're really seeing is a shift to neighborhood-based approaches so that cities are using data to really understand where there's the highest risk for violence and really directing their resources in a coordinated way to really impact neighborhoods in fundamental ways and really bring down violence rates within those neighborhoods. And then I think also importantly what we've seen, and I think this is highlighted by, you know, having two public health departments represented in this conversation, is that there's really now a growing recognition of public health's role and contribution, and that public health departments are stepping up to play a leadership role in their cities and engaging young people in this work. So it's very promising, and it's really a shift in a very short period of time in terms of how cities are taking this issue on. And what we're seeing is that it's working. And, you know, I'm sure that Sasha and Chris can really talk about some of the statistics in their own cities, but that what we see is that where these kind of approaches take hold, that rates of violence and crime go down while arrest rates go down.
Chris and Sasha, from your perspectives?
Chris, did you want to add something?
Chris, if you're talking, you may have muted yourself.
No, I'm sorry. I think I lost the connection there. I'm back, though. I hear you guys now. Sorry. So I don't know, I didn't hear, Sasha, what you added, and I missed the end of Rachel's remarks, so I apologize if I'm going over stuff that y'all have already said, but two observations that I have about how the field is changing in exciting ways are, first, that there is increasingly a national community around this public health approach. That work was really kind of pioneered by folks like Rachel at the Prevention Institute to bring these communities together to be able to share what they're working on and know that they're not the only place that is taking this type of approach to the issue. And then the other thing that we've also sort of touched on a bit is this movement to draw connections between the various modalities of violence and adopt sort of an integrated response to violence as a whole. So not seeing youth violence, child maltreatment, intimate partner violence, bullying, et cetera, as separate and distinct issues, but part of sort of an overall whole of violence that can be addressed and needs to be addressed in a coordinated and integrated fashion.
And in Minneapolis, we've really been looking at youth violence in particular as a public health issue since 2008. At that time, we had a significant peak in youth violence here in the Twin Cities, and then Mayor R.T. Ryback really felt as though it would be important to address the issue and in a comprehensive way to use public health as, you know, the way that we approach the work. Since that time, we've developed our Blueprint for Action to Prevent Youth Violence, which has been a great strategic plan for the city. It was recently revamped in 2012 when we joined the National Forum on Youth Violence Prevention. But what it really has done is to pull together all of our city departments, our school board, our school leadership and administration, our police department, obviously public health, our mayor's office, to really pull everyone together at the table. And I think that that has helped us to develop some work that has been since used as a national model to really think about comprehensive strategies around youth violence prevention. So we continue to learn, but really feel like the public health approach and the strategic planning in particular have been great tools.
And You know, you all talking about the changes in the last few years, and I think the growing momentum. There are also these national initiatives that are happening. Tasha, you just mentioned the National Forum on Youth Violence Prevention. There's Cities United and Unity. I don't know if you want to speak to those, and, you know, what is it saying about sort of the prevention field that all of this is emerging?
Well, I think it's been tremendously important. UNITY was first funded starting in about 2005 by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to really advance a public health approach among cities. And I think, as Chris sort of alluded to, that that's been one part of creating sort of a national community around this approach where, you know, as we've learned more and more about what to do and understand what it takes to prevent violence, that folks working independently in cities were sort of lone islands in some ways. And bringing folks together to learn from each other and to have a mechanism for that kind of sharing and spread of what's working and how has been incredibly important. I think overall the emergence of these multiple initiatives is a strong statement that this is a really important issue that's core to having a thriving city, that it's really a central element of it. And unfortunately, on a national level, we haven't yet developed the social and political will to really insist that we fundamentally, in a big way, do something about it. So it's really been on cities to take this challenge on without the kinds of resources and supports that could really be helpful. So I think these national initiatives are part of making the case for that and that needing to happen.
Sasha, Chris, anything you want to add from your perspective?
No, I would just add that, you know, being both member cities of UNITY as well as the National Forum on Youth Violence Prevention have proven to be great resources to the city of Minneapolis and have given us the opportunity to share the work that we're doing, but more importantly, really to learn on a national level what other cities are doing, to see what cities who are similar size to us as well as cities who are a little larger or a little smaller are thinking about and doing as it pertains to youth violence prevention. So I think the idea of developing these learning communities for youth violence prevention work have been really helpful. When I think sort of back to my days of being on the ground worker in youth development and youth violence prevention, it is a very isolating world to be in because, first of all, a lot of the times people don't want to talk strategically about violence prevention outside of the violence prevention community. So getting people to come to the table and talk about violence prevention can be a challenge. So having a network of cities who are all doing the work and are able to talk about it and understand it on the same level has been incredibly helpful. I think it's also helped to build national momentum with policymakers and educators and other decision makers to be able to think more critically about what we need to do as whole communities around youth violence prevention.
Yeah, Sasha mentioned the importance of strategic planning, and for us, that's been the really critical, and I think it's important for communities to organize themselves around the issue of violence in a strategic and thoughtful way. For us, being a part of the forum, being a part of the UNITY Cities Network has been an opportunity for us to organize ourselves really around the issue of violence from a prevention frame specifically. Addressing the issue of violence is the mayor's top priority, and he asked us to be a part of that. But joining the forum and being a part of UNITY really gave us tools, connections to other cities to be able to organize our prevention work and pay really close attention to that, so that we could carve out the role that the health department could play here specifically and in more detail than just sort of broadly saying, we're going to work on prevention, we're going to adopt this public health approach, which of course is important, but the forum and UNITY gave us the opportunity to drill down on that a lot more.
So now I think it's, you know, time to really talk about some of the concrete things that are happening, because I think New Orleans and Minneapolis both created the strategic plan, or at least published the strategic plan, maybe a year ago. So want to hear what what's exciting, what's been successful first. And we did have a question come in that you may be able to incorporate some response to in that answer, was about how are you integrating youth voice in this entire effort. So let's start with, what's been exciting, and then afterwards we'll talk about what remains challenging. Chris, you want to start us off?
Sure. So I should mention from the outset that our strategic plan to prevent youth violence is called the NOLA for Life Playbook. But I should acknowledge, both of my colleagues on the line here, Minneapolis's work beginning in 2008 was really inspirational and influential for us. And the support of the Prevention Institute was really critical for us as well in putting this plan together. So the work that I'm going to describe here shortly would not be possible without the other folks who are on the line here. And that, again, I think speaks to the spirit of community and collaboration that exists in the field at the moment, which is really exciting. Our plan sets a high-level goal that by 2020, 95% of our youth will feel safe in their schools and in their neighborhoods. We chose that goal in part because it's aligned with the benchmarks of Healthy People 2020, the federal government's national health benchmarks. And so our focus is really on three things, preventing school violence, preventing family violence, and then building our own capacity as a health department to be able to sustain this work. One of the challenges, I don't want to get too far ahead, but one of the challenges of this approach is that it's got a long time horizon. So if we're really effective at preventing youth violence, we won't know that until 5 or 10 years from now, when prevention strategies have really had the opportunity to play themselves out. And so we're building our capacity to be able to sustain this work and be a player in the field for a significant period of time going forward. One of the specific strategies I'll talk about actually involves youth voice to some extent, and so I think I'll hopefully touch on some of the listeners' questions. We did involve youth in the planning of the playbook. I had some direct conversations with young people to ask them about their issues, and are working currently on putting together a youth engagement strategy to make sure that youth voice is heard in a significant and sustained way going forward, and that there's some real structure around youth because we view them as partners in this work and not as just recipients or clients. They are really our partners in this work. So one of the ways that we have involved them to date, and we hope to build on this, is through our work in schools to promote restorative approaches as an alternate discipline strategy to zero tolerance or what's sometimes called exclusionary discipline practices. Restorative approaches sort of emphasize conflict resolution and teaching kids skills to be able to resolve issues before they become really, really challenging and difficult. So in a school that's using restorative approaches, what might happen, for example, if two kids get in a fight, is that instead of being suspended or expelled, those two kids will be asked to sit in a community conference with one another. In some cases, this is even the conference is facilitated with and by a peer, another young person. So it's a really exciting way for young people to be involved and take some ownership over solving problems that they experience in schools. And so we've seen some success around that. In particular, I've got a quote from a publication that we're about to put out about the use of restorative approaches in schools, where an eighth grade student says that he's talking about one of the community conferences and restorative approaches in schools. And he says, "I thought it was just going to be another little talk to tell us not to worry about it and go our separate ways. But the circle made us talk and work out our differences. Without it, we would have never talked to each other again." This work is really about directly engaging with young people at its core. It's about engaging with young people and fostering those connections and relationships. And we've started to see some real success for that, both with young people, but also with the practitioners and professionals in the field here.
Great. Sasha?
Well, you know, our blueprint has been around since 2008, and it really is the guidebook kind of format that Chris was just speaking about. Really, our blueprint uses five goal areas to help structure the work that we do here in Minneapolis. So we look at how do we create how do we create violent-free social environments? It's kind of a mouthful. How do we ensure that all young people in Minneapolis are connected to at least one caring adult? How do we intervene at the first sign of risk with youth and families? How do we restore youth who have gone down the wrong path, which really speaks to reentry and working with young people who have already had some engagement with the juvenile justice system, and then maintaining safety for youth and families in the community. And that's really speaking to enforcement. How do we make sure that law enforcement is at the table and fully engaged on best practices when engaging with young people, even if it isn't an arrest situation, making sure that it's age appropriate and does the least harm to a young person as possible. So that's the framework that we use, and we've been using that work for the last, 8 years now. I think that our goal moving forward is to really integrate that even further into the city's framework. As I mentioned, we have a new mayor, and Mayor Hodges is thoroughly committed to the work, but it is a different framework from former Mayor Hodges or Mayor Rybak. So, you know, we're in the first year of her term and trying to make sure that her vision around early childhood lines up with what we've been doing for the last several years around the work. I do want to touch on the youth engagement piece that the caller had. We in Minneapolis try really hard to make sure that we do have a youth voice. We're fortunate enough to have a youth congress in Minneapolis, so there are 40 young people from around the city who are actually appointed and sworn in and serve as a youth congress to help advise and offer youth input into policy for the city. So they offer advice to all of the city departments. They're available to help offer input and provide a youth voice, but they're also thoroughly trained on how to be young leaders, on how to offer input and be at the table in a way that is constructive. And so it's really a leadership opportunity for them. I know that our youth coordinating board, who really oversees our youth congress, are always, their motto is no say, like, I can't remember it now, but it really speaks to the idea,
Sasha,
that, yes.
Sorry, I was just so impressed when I was in Minneapolis with this. So if I could just chime in, because it just seems so clear. The no decision about us without us.
Thank
was
you.
Just
I couldn't pull
so
it out of my head.
So core for the young people in Minneapolis,
yes.
And it really stood out. So
thank you. I could not pull it out of my head. I apologize. But thank you so much for reminding me of what their slogan is. And I was just in a meeting with them yesterday, so I should have been able to remember. But that is really the key of the Youth Congress. No decision about us without us, and really making sure that their voice is at the table and is in a youthful way, and that they're proactive about getting what they want. So they have a variety of subcommittees that meet regularly on issues like transportation. They have a health committee. They have a public safety committee and education committee. So they are really actively working just like any other board or commission would on the issues that are important to them and offering up advice to city departments and city leadership. So I just wanted to say that is one of the ways that we ensure that young people are at the table. But we also have two slots on our steering committee for the youth violence prevention work at the city level that are reserved for young people. For two youth at all times. So we always have at least two people around our executive committee table who are under the age of 24 offering insight and input on what we do, next steps, how we move forward with our work. And I know that I'm supposed to speak a little bit to the challenges of implementation around the work, and I would certainly say that for us, part of it is continuously keeping people at the table. Everyone is continuing to move forward on the work, but the coordination is so important, and making sure that people stay tied into the bigger picture and not just drilling down on their one little piece, but seeing how it connects to everyone else's work is, you know, one of the areas that always has to be tweaked and worked on. Certainly when you think about the number of community partners that have to be at the table to carry this kind of work forward and that it's not always people within city government that are making the change. It's really important to be out actively in the community, working with county and state partners as well. You know, each one has its own system of how they get the work done. So those are some of the challenges I think we've experienced here in Minneapolis.
And Rachel, I do want to hear from you because you have so much exposure to other communities. But before we do, I want to remind our listeners, if they want to call and speak to our guests live on air, to dial 347-994-1149, and you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad. And a question that has come in through the chat room is about balancing. I mean, I think, Sasha, you had mentioned the wide array of all the types of violence that are incorporated into this prevention plan. So how does all of that work? And so, Rachel, you may be seeing communities sort of struggling with that, too, like what to incorporate into a prevention model. So why don't you start and tell us, like, what Chris and Sasha were talking about, is that something very similar to what other communities are doing, and what are some other challenges that are out there?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that there that the kinds of things that Chris and Sasha are talking about are, you know, that there's some real common themes that we're seeing in cities that are making this work. And, you know, when Chris talked about, you know, 90% of youth feeling safe as really like almost the vision, and having a strong vision that everyone can get behind is really important. And we see that time and again, that these glue together better when there is, you know, a shared vision. Another thing both of them have talked about is high-level leadership and commitment, you know, having mayors that are prioritizing this issue, demanding the violence stops and holding people accountable is incredibly important. And at the same time, having the community engagement, voice, and empowerment as sort of a top-down, bottom-up, you know, that both of those pieces are really important, and that the communities most impacted by violence have to be part of prioritizing the solutions and implementing the solutions. Another thing that I think was clear in terms of what they were both talking about and maybe was driving a part of the question that came in, is that this is really not about a single program, that this is about a complement of strategies across a continuum. And really, I think that one of the advantages of a public health approach in terms of sorting that out is that, you know, we have some pretty good evidence on what the risk factors are that are most likely to increase the likelihood of violence, and we know what the resilience factors are that can be protective against it. And then, you know, cities have the chance to really look at how those play out within their, you know, communities and within their neighborhoods, and that being clear on those and the data around those can really help identify what are the strategies that are going to work in a particular city. So, you know, there's really a growing number of cities with plans, and there's some common themes across those plans, but they all look a little bit different. And so, you know, even though, for example, New Orleans looked at what Minneapolis was doing, their plan looks different from Minneapolis's. And then the other thing that's so important is that coordination piece that Sasha talked about. And that doesn't just happen by accident, that having people like Sasha and like Chris who are responsible for coordinating, you know, across community, across sectors of government, and across the different efforts that are going on is really critical, because this doesn't just happen in one place. And so I think increasingly we're really seeing the emergence of staffing to help support these efforts, and that's been really critical in terms of success. And, you know, I think the challenges in addition to, you know, what's already been said, is that, you know, cities really, there aren't enough resources for cities to do this work in the way that the problem warrants. And I already had sort of referred to this sort of lack of political, you know, will and resources. So cities are kind of, you know, when they choose to prioritize this, are trying to make it work. And there's challenges to doing that.
Chris, I know you had mentioned, I'm jumping ahead to challenges. So I didn't know if there was anything that you didn't get a chance to say that you wanted to.
Well, one challenge that I think is worth noting for communities that are considering this is how important and difficult it can be to message the value of prevention. And that's something that we really try to push ourselves to do on a regular basis. Because unfortunately, in communities like New Orleans, like Minneapolis, like places around the country, violence is prevalent, and so it's going to happen, and really bad, tragic things are going to happen, particular cases that galvanize leaders and communities, and often galvanize them in a way that is not focused on prevention. So when something really bad happens, people feel the urge to respond to that situation, and we're compelled to. We have to. It's entirely justifiable. But oftentimes, in all of that talk about amping up law enforcement and tougher sentencing and things like that, conversations about prevention get lost, and people forget about how we can think about stopping this kind of thing from happening in the first place. I know that's happened to us since we started this work on a number of occasions. You know, had some particularly bad killings over the summer that really galvanized folks in a way around the issue of violence. And it's important to be galvanized around it, but in a way that wasn't focused on prevention, and that I don't know how productive it was ultimately. And so we really try to combat that by constantly pushing out the value of prevention, why this matters, how we know it works, how we can measure it, and why we think it's ultimately transformative for our community.
That's such an important point. I think that there's really a kind of skepticism about whether or not prevention can really work. And I think part of the value, and you know, we were talking earlier about all of these national initiatives and a national community around this, is that that's been an opportunity to really lift up the growing number of examples of where this is working and to really reinforce the notion that this is preventable, because continuing to sort of hold up, as Chris was saying, the value of prevention has to include countering some of the skepticism about whether it will work or not.
And I think that that's particularly important because it's so difficult to measure prevention and to be able to take credit for the hard work that goes into developing a strategic plan and then really looking at the outcomes. I know that in Minneapolis since 2008, we've seen a significant drop in youth violence, in particular as it pertains to homicides here in Minneapolis. We were fortunate enough in 2013 to actually get our number of youth homicides down to under to zero. We had zero youth homicides in 2013, which is, you know, amazing. But we also know that there are lots of contributing factors. And while we believe that the work that we've done on the ground and strategically with county, city, state partners has made an impact, it's not something that we take sole credit for either. And so I think particularly from a funding position, it's very difficult to say we did this, and so this is why prevention works. And that's the other grapple or thing that we have to grapple with as people who work strategically in prevention, is that it's not just our efforts that make the difference.
We have just about 10 minutes left. And Sasha and Chris, I want to hear what advice you have for other communities that want to engage in this. And then, Rachel, we had a question come in that you mentioned. We know what the resiliency factors are. People want to know what they are. So why don't we start with that question? Why don't you tell us what the resiliency factors are, and then let's turn to the advice you have for other communities, okay?
Yeah, so there's a number of resilience factors, and they can be at the individual and the family and the community level. We know, for example, at the individual level that having a caring adult, and that's one of the core tenets of Minneapolis's plan, but having a caring adult in a young person's life is protective. Having high expectations and having meaningful opportunities for participation are all protective. At a community level, things like strong cohesion and trust within a community. So, you know, do neighbors know each other and talk to each other, or are they willing to take collective action for the common good is very protective. And that we know increasingly that there's also factors in the built environment around design and reducing alcohol outlet density that can also be protective. There's been a lot more research on the risk factors, but really a growing number of factors that can be protective against the likelihood of violence. And what's important about those factors is that they're protective even in the presence of risk factors. So they can really counter the negative impacts of risk factors.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay. Sasha and Chris, what advice do you have for other communities interested in starting a public health effort, given your roles? You must have some lessons learned.
Chris, would you like to start?
No, you go ahead.
Well, first, let me say that I am relatively new to my position. So I've been working in violence prevention for the last several years, but really looking more at a domestic violence lens and how it impacts children and youth. And prior to that, really in corrections. And so sort of merging those two efforts is what has brought me to this position that I'm in now. The lessons that I have learned are, one, that you really need to lean on your community partners and really think broadly about who those people are. So our plan has been around since 2008, and we've had varying partners at the table, some who have, you know, were there in the beginning and who had to leave for competing reasons or, you know, a variety of reasons. People come and go out of the work, but really trying to and communities change. So it's important to constantly be evolving and be looking at who's missing from the table. How do we pull in people who hadn't historically been here? And to really think outside of the box about how you get people to the table, because violence, even though we know it's overly reflected in certain communities, it really is something that impacts the quality of life of all citizens in a city. And so trying to make sure that everyone who has an invested interest has an opportunity to share with you their ideas, I think, is really important. But I think also knowing that there's no perfect plan, that it's always going to be needing to be tweaked. And then also really developing that leadership, finding a champion, someone who can really help carry the work forward from a leadership perspective, whether that be a mayor or a city council person or some other elected official or person of authority in your community, but really having someone who's in the limelight, who champions the work, can really make a huge impact.
Chris?
So my comments are going to echo Sasha's to some extent, but I think the most important thing for cities to do or communities to do first is to organize themselves around the issue of violence. You know, I've mentioned that a little bit earlier previously, but to have a plan around this, like our community has, like Minneapolis has, like many others have now around the country, is really important to have an organized and strategic approach to this, one that's really thought out, is backed by research and evidence, but is also has significant buy-in. We, too, have found it critical to engage partners in this work. We can't do it alone, as a governmental agency. There's many, many other people who need to be involved. But given sort of where we sit and the topic of today's discussion, would really encourage audience members to engage their local health department and other partners in the field of health, clinics, hospitals, other partners that are out there in the field of health that have resources, expertise, talent to bear on this issue. And engaging youth as part of that is critical as well, and we've talked a little bit about that. As with Minneapolis, we found it critical to have committed high-level leadership. So we're really fortunate to have a mayor who understands this is a public health issue, understands why prevention matters. So you've got to have somebody who can be that voice, as Sasha has said. I would also say that we've found it really important to peg success to metrics, to find a measurable way, whether it's youth safety or the number of youth homicides or some way to measure success so that you can say at the end of the day, we know this worked because we have these measures to show that, a way to track progress. And then lastly, you know, I'll just echo another point that Sasha made, that no plan is perfect. You've got to have a plan, but too often planning processes can get lost in the process. And at some point, you got to wrap up the plan and say, this is good enough to move forward. We can continue to refine this, but we need to move forward with acting. So, you know, I would encourage folks to not strive for perfection, but just strive for really, really good, because that's going to be sufficient to move forward and to really begin implementing action and solutions.
Okay. Thank you. And for those listening who may be looking for more resources, I would encourage you to go to preventioninstitute.org, cdc.gov, nationalgangcenter.gov, NOLA.gov, Minneapolis, MN.gov, both Minneapolis and New Orleans have their prevention strategic plans up there. So it's time for final thoughts, and we're looking at 60 seconds or less from each of you. And I just would also remind you that many of our listeners are from a juvenile justice background, so if you can think about how to relate your work to that, that would be wonderful. Okay, Rachel?
So, you know, first of all, I would say that it can be a little overwhelming to hear from folks like Sasha and Chris, whose stuff is so well developed. And you got to start somewhere. So, you know, I would encourage you to take it as inspiring and hopeful, and as you know, models for how this can be prevented. I think, you know, people that are in the juvenile justice system really see the consequences of us not investing in prevention enough and understand what some of the core issues and needs are of young people, and that can really help inform a violence prevention plan in your community. And my experience is that folks from the justice sector have been some of the most important champions and advocates for prevention taking hold. So, you know, this is really meant to be complementary with what's already going on in juvenile justice and hopefully reduce the number of young people that are entering the juvenile justice system.
Terrific. Sasha?
I would just echo what was just said as far as how important having juvenile justice partners at the table really is. My own background academically is in criminal justice. And certainly have spent many years working in the criminal justice and juvenile justice systems, and in that time really thought a lot about how good it would be if there was something that we could do for young people before they got into the deep end. How could we help to provide programming and services to families who were just having a hard time and couldn't wrap their head around what the young people needed before it got to a point where they were in deep in corrections. And so often it requires young people being in deep in corrections for them to get services. So this is an opportunity for corrections folks to come and give us input about what the needs are before it gets to that point. So I would just I think that that is so important. Our work in Minneapolis continues to grow and shift, but the importance of using public health is really a framework, and it requires so many other partners being at the table, including corrections. So thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you. And Chris, final thoughts? Brett.
Yeah, I would, as everybody else has said, concur that juvenile justice folks are critical partners in this. Here, our local juvenile court chief judge is a huge champion and advocate for this work, and is a critical partner of ours. So this work can't be done without them. And I'll just close by encouraging folks to embrace the challenge of this work. It's huge. It's massive. It can be daunting, as Rachel has said. And the solutions are ultimately going to be big ones, but you can start small and break off some parts and start with some early conversations with a small group of folks, and then build those partnerships and strengthen your network and go from there. It can be done. We're, you know, newcomers to this field, have really only been working in the field of violence prevention for 2 or 3 years, and have really ramped up our activities quickly. So New Orleans is sort of a test case in how this work can be done to some extent, and our work continues to grow, to develop, to be refined. And so folks, you know, again, shouldn't let perfect be the enemy of good in their work, and really encourage folks to take this work on. Thanks.
So to stay informed about upcoming shows, you can follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at childrenslawky.org. Sasha, Rachel, Chris, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a lot of wonderful information.
Thank you.
Thanks
for
having us.
Very pleased you're covering this topic.
Mm-hmm. So take care, everyone.
It was a pleasure.
See you next time on Spotlight on Youth.
Thank you. Bye-bye.